I think Rabbi Mandel will present the OU's position, and I'm not sure exactly what he's going to speak about, but maybe I don't know if he knows. But maybe this will be. I wanted to greet the people that came not only from Eretz Yisrael to our conference, but we have people here I know from Vancouver, from Tucson, and from my city, Muncie, New York. And Muncie, we'd like to welcome. They traveled specially across the country to get here. And Muncie, New York made the headlines last year around this time, I believe, the famous Muncie meat scandal. And I would hope that Rabbi Mandel would also address that as part of his talk, the integrity of the kosher meat chain from farm to table. And we really want to express the appreciation of the OU to Rabbi Mandel, not only for traveling all around the world to secure the integrity of the OU meat supply, but also for arranging many of the foods that will be eaten tonight, which needed a lot of special work. We give a big yashar koach to Rabbi Seth Mandel.
What do we do with this? Okay. I did have a topic that I was going to talk about, but before I start on that, I want to clear up a few things of perhaps misinformation or not entirely clear from the from previous lectures, because I'm the one who's found in the field and I'm the one who goes to the Schlachtheiser and goes among the cows, and I can tell you what goes on there. First of all, there was a Rabbi Weil mentioned that the percentage of kosher cattle in the percentage of kosher animals in South America is much greater. That is not because of the temperature. It's a very simple thing. You can get a high percentage of animals which are kosher in America too if you don't stress out the animal. Animals don't like to be stressed out. How did the Kodesh Baruch Hu create cattle? To wander around the field and eat grass. That's what they like to do. You put them in a pen with lots of appetizing, what to our eyes is appetizing cornmeal, and you leave the door of the pen open, they won't touch the cornmeal, they want to go out and eat the grass. That's what they like. If you let them behave the way the Kodesh Baruch Hu intended, let them go out in the field, you get an extremely high percentage of kosher. And you understand how Chazal say that most of the behemoths are kosher. And so in Uruguay, where the animals are grass-fed, simply because the whole animal is a pasture land, and there's no reason to spend money on anything else. You just let them out in the pasture all the time. The percentage of glatt kosher animals there is about 70%. And in the United States, as we've heard, it's between 30 and 35%. Because in the United States, what do you do to these animals? You close them up so they can't go out and eat grass like they want to. You feed them. Your question? You feed them not only cornmeal, but cornmeal with fat added. Cheapest source of fat nowadays is animal fat. The fat that's left over from the animals that you can't make into salami, they dump it into the animal feed. These poor behemoths are eating corn with oil. They get very stressed out. They really don't like it. And because of that, the percentage of glatt tanks. They can, but it becomes fat. That's why Americans, when Rabbi Weil was talking about juicy, tender meat means lots of fat in it. That regular meat, if you buy Uruguayan beef, which is available, you can get perfectly all-natural Uruguayan beef here in L.A., you can get it across the country. It's very, very healthy, much healthier than the other stuff. But Americans don't like it because it's not as soft. It doesn't have so much fat. When you cook it, the fat flows out and sautés the rest of it. As a corollary to that, we were talking about veal before. The percentage of kosher veal is 10% on a good day. Why? Look at the way they treat the animals. This is not a matter of how they treat them in the slaughterhouse and how we're being cruel and inhumane to the in the slaughterhouse. It's simply a fact of the matter that Americans like this kind of meat. Americans want to buy this kind of meat. Farmers oblige them. I've said over Shabbos, if you don't like the farmers treating the animals this way, vote with your wallet and buy either natural or organic meat, which is not treated that way, and then the farmers won't do it. The farmers don't care. They're just selling what the consumer wants. And as far as the slaughterhouses go, we don't grow. Kosher cattle is not, except for the organic and except for some of the specialty items like bison, normally the cattle that you eat are the same as the cattle as the non-Jews eat. They're bought at auction. Okay. A comment about the zebu. We heard a lot about the zebu. I just want to add a couple of facts that I'm not sure everybody was aware of. You perhaps got the impression from Rebbe Vosner's tshuva that since Bnei Brak was the mokim of the Chazon Ish, they should be choshesh for the das of the Chazon Ish. It's a very nice idea, but lemaisa, you know, you go to Vishnitz, which is headquartered in Bnei Brak, and say, you should follow the Chazon Ish, and they'll look at you and they say, we've been here just as long as the Chazon Ish. We don't follow him. You know, we have our own posik, the Rebbe. Lemaisa, I lived in Bnei Brak 25 years ago, and the Chuk Chazon Ish, the Chuk Chazon Ish followed the Chazon Ish. The rest of Bnei Brak did not follow the Chazon Ish. There was Rav Vosner, there were other poskim. This was not, it later became, the Zebul issue became in Eretz Yisrael as if, you know, we should all be choshish for the time of the Chazon Ish, but after the time of the Chazon Ish, only the yeshiva of the Chazon Ish and the chug of the Chazon Ish observed his chumos. It isn't like he was accepted like the poisek in all Eretz Yisrael. And as a matter of fact, I can tell you, I went to the shlachtoys. The closest shlachtoys to Bnei Brak was in Pesach Tikva, an old shlachtoys, and there they were shechting animals which were crossbred with zebu. The whole issue came up because they imported a purebred brahmin. But everybody who knew anything about animals in Eretz Yisrael knew that all the animals in Eretz Yisrael were crossbred, because if you go ask a farmer in the United States, they talk about two breeds, European and exotic. Exotic means things like the zebu, the charolais. In Europe, in the climate in Europe, the European cattle thrive. You bring them down to Texas in the United States, you brought them down to Eretz Yisrael, they start dying. They can't stand the temperature change. They always used in Eretz Yisrael a mixture, just like in Texas. There is no pure breed Angus without a little of the other ones bred in, because it simply won't survive. And so the Maisa, I can tell you that after the time of the Chazon Ish, the animals that were being shechted were a crossbreed. Okay. I don't remember what his tshuva said, but I will add something else. If you want to really understand what the Chazon Ish was writing when he asserted, read the tshuva carefully. Read the tshuva carefully. It's printed into Eor Hador. He says, "Achshav Yomenu, when everybody's running after reform, you have to close the gates." Chazon Ish was very, you know, a Gadol Hador. He knew what he was talking about. He was not, I believe, just like Rav Moshe Feinstein took some positions which were deliberately against the conservatives. I believe that the Chazon Ish was trying to stop appeal in the ghetto. He saw what was happening in Eretz Yisrael in his time, and everything is breaking down, and everybody's following new. Everybody says, I can do this, I can do that, and he wanted to stop it in its tracks. And so on page 41, the third paragraph before the end, Sof tovo bizmanenu sheshoafim al hareforma ila efshor lasis dvorim hanirim kematirim. You have to stop the piyotza, because if anybody who knows what went on in Eretz Yisrael in the Chazon Ish's time, it was mamish a piyotza.
What year is this?
What? We're talking about the 1940s. Well, actually, that was in the 1940s, I believe, when they started importing that. Okay, enough about that. Yes. To develop adhesions in the lung. No, sirchas in the lungs. Sirchas in the lungs are caused. Excuse me, let me answer. Sirchas in the lungs are adhesions. There are different kinds of adhesions. In medicine, there are protein adhesions and there are mucus adhesions. Mucus adhesions come whenever the animal is suffering stress and he begins to get sick. The mucus adhesions in the lungs appear. The stress causes illness in the animals. That's a fact. You're asking me what bacteria causes it. It isn't bacteria. The animals start feeling bad and they start coughing. No. They're not. They don't have pneumonia. Who said anything about pneumonia? I said they have sirchas in the lungs. They don't have pneumonia. You have sirchas in the lungs. Probably if most human beings who are above a certain age have sirchas in the lungs. It's not to mean they have pneumonia or they're medically dying. It means they have sirchas. They have when you cough, it's usually because you have a mucus adhesion in the lung or outside the lung. Okay, going on. Let me talk about the ones that got away, because you see, it's directly connected. We were planning all sorts of things for tonight, and we got, Baruch Hashem, we got some things, but we missed out on one of the thing we would really like to show, because everybody would really get a kick out of it. I don't mean that literally. The giraffe. We were going to shech the giraffe. We had assembled donations because giraffes cost between $20,000 and $25,000 each, and the OU certainly was not going to pay for this. And we had assembled donations. We had talked with Rabbi Belsky, and Rabbi Belsky said, fine, you know, go right ahead. But we couldn't find a giraffe that was 1 year old or less. Like I just said to you, the older you get, the more sirchas you have in your lungs. I can promise you that if you opened me up, or if you could see, my lungs would be full of sirchas. It doesn't mean I'm keeling over and ready to die. This is just a fact of life. To spend $25,000 on an animal, which was 2 years old, when the chances were very good that it was not going to be kosher, that is simply, I felt, about tashchis. We didn't pursue it. So what we did was Ari came up with the idea of yak. And yak, so what I did was I got in touch with a yak farmer and farheld him for an hour over the phone about what animals they have, what's the state of health of each animal. And we sat here on Murray the yak, which he proudly drove down to us. And we have a picture of me conversing with Murray the yak when he came to try to figure out. And he was not only kosher, he was kelbeleglat. He was a really healthy animal, no sirchas at all. But that's the sort of thing you have to do. The yak was a lot cheaper. The yak costs like three times as much as a steer, but nothing like a giraffe. And giraffe, we were just not going. It doesn't seem to be reasonable. It doesn't seem to be ethical to spend $25,000 on an animal which probably will not be kosher. But what I do want you to remember from this, giraffe is kosher, and we could shecht it. Like Ari said, shechting a giraffe is like hitting the side of a barn. Picking up on that, yes, Rabbi Korobkin. Okay, going back one step, but remind me where I was. This is the issue in the feedlots. Most animals are, we talked about, they don't like being in the feedlots. The farmers, it's expensive for them to buy all this oil and fat and cornmeal to feed them. So the so the farmers pump the animals full of growth hormones to make them fatten up quicker so that they can get to the... It's very economic. This is why you have cheap meat in America, because they're using growth hormones. If you left the animal to get fat by eating gauze, how long do you think it's going to take an animal to get fat by eating gauze? It's never going to get very fat. And it's going to take a year, whereas pumping it through with growth hormones is going to take a couple of months. Okay? That's why they do it. And they pump them through with antibiotics, because now that the animal's on growth hormones, the animal's health is very wobbly. They get sick very easily. Once one animal gets sick, he starts infecting all the other animals which are closed in the feedlot with him. So they have to fill them full of antibiotics so they won't get sick. That's why natural beef costs 40% more, because if one animal gets sick, there are no growth hormones. Take us a lot longer to fatten them up. And no animal protein, no animal fat in the diet, only vegetable oil. And if one animal gets sick, they immediately have to remove the animal and they can't sell it for natural. That's the economics of the issue. Okay. We could check the giraffe if we got a giraffe. Maybe next time we have this conference, we will start early enough so that we can get a 1-year-old giraffe. Yes.
Anyone in the world eat a giraffe?
No. Giraffe is only for the show that it's a kosher animal. Nobody, not even the Africans.
Yeah. There is one restaurant in Kenya.
In Kenya.
Called the Carnivore.
Right.
And Kishmoy Kenu. And I was in touch with them about giraffe. They said they indeed serve giraffe. And that's the other reason one of the young animals. They said the older it is, the harder, the tougher the meat. And they said if you're going to slaughter one,
right,
the young one.
The giraffes, the older giraffes, even the Africans don't eat. The Africans eat all the meat, the bush meat, the monkeys, everything they find, but they won't eat an old giraffe. It's just so tough. Going on. I just wanted to explain a little bit about now that we've talked about all the svaras, what the OU paskins, halacha lemaisa, on all these things. After sitting down with Rabbi Belsky for an hour with Chaim Loiki and discussing what we should do about this, because one of my jobs after joining the OU is to try to codify and standardize the practices in meat, and a lot of times they weren't. Nothing. Whereas in other areas, the OU has done a very good job of codifying and standardizing practices. In meat, really, there was nothing that was fixed. I spent an hour with Rabbi Belsky, and then I wrote up this document, which is on page one. That's my computer writing, and we brought it to Rabbi Belsky, and he signed it on the bottom that it accurately reflected his views. What are his views? In light, there are several things that go into this, and all of them have been discussed, but I want you to understand how the OU is noheg in this area. The OU takes no position on teimonim eating chagovim. Adraba, the Rabbi Belsky's view, and my own personal view, is if they have an authentic Mesorah and the guy is a bar samcha, but the guy is not, you know, just a guy off the street who remembers eating chagovim, but actually is an expert in them, the OU says he can rely on his masero. But the OU is inappropriate. The OU's position is the OU only goes on stuff which is shoveh lechol nefesh, in general. We're not going to put an OU on rice on Pesach, even though the Sfardim who eat right are welcome to follow their masero. But we won't put the OU on it, because then it means anybody, the housewife, the proverbial housewife in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, who buys rice with the OU on it, is going to, and says kosher for Pesach, she's going to assume she can eat it for Pesach, and Ashkenazim don't have that custom. So the OU is not going to put the OU on a product which only one kahila will eat and the other kahila won't eat. We won't put an OU on a product which only Hungarians eat and other people don't eat. We won't put an OU on a product which only Taimonim eat or Moroccans eat and other people don't eat. This is not a reflection of our view of the authenticity of their Masero. It's a reflection of the fact that the OU as an organization wants to be something which the housewife in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, can use without becoming a rav. That means that all meat with the OU is glatt. There is no non-glatt meat with the OU. Beis Yosef is a different issue because Beis Yosef is more or less a recent chumrah among the Ashkenazim. We are working on standards that will say that when will it say OU Beit Yosef, but all meat that has OU is glatt. Okay? Now, yes? The what? Almost, to our knowledge, all of the kilot, yes. I don't want to get caught up into this. We have too many things to go through. The D as opposed to the DE, that's a different issue. On tuna fish? We believe that according to the Shulchan Aruch, anybody can eat dark tuna fish. If somebody's going to come to the OU, and say, I want to be machmir, yeah, the Shulchan Aruch says this, but I want to be machmir more than the Shulchan Aruch, that's not in our policy statement. We say, adavar l'shav l'chol nefesh, according to the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah. There are lots of chumras going around, which are not from the Mechaber and the Ramah. Let's leave Sakanta Mi'isura aside. Okay. Yes. No. Meat or the meat supply in America is the majority from the United States, from the Midwest. A small amount, particularly a veal, more than a small amount from Canada, and from processed meat, including briskets and corned beef and sausage and salami. A lot of that comes from Uruguay. Okay. Now,
Let me just make. We're running late, and he has a large presentation. We're going to have like two or three questions at the end. I'm sorry. Please write down your questions and take it at the end.
Yes, we're talking about the animals that you're going to eat tonight. I explained how the giraffe was doing, how the yak was done. We also did elk. This is an issue I want to talk to you about because Ari Zivotofsky talked a little bit about that one of the chief rabbis in Israel says that red deer is not kosher, even though he doesn't have a source for it. The issue was, as Ari pointed out, not that there is any source that says it's not kosher, but because there is a tooth on the upper jaw. But when we went and discussed with Rabbi Belsky, we showed him the skull, not just saying, oh, there's a tooth in the upper skull. If you remember that picture, the tooth is not like one of the canines. It comes down like a miniature tusk, and that's exactly what those tooths are. They're the parallel of the tusk in the elephant. They cannot be used for chewing. They're not like the incisors, and they're not like the canine teeth. It's like a tooth. If it were a little bit longer, it would jut out the side of the mouth. And the red deer uses it, it's called the bugler tooth, because during the mating season, they use it to make a whistle to attract the females. It's never, ever used for eating. So on the basis of that, after seeing the skull, that's why Rabbi Belsky said, okay, in this case, I don't believe that we have to be choshesh, because this is not lemaise a shame. This is more like a tusk. But just to be sure, he wanted us to get edus from somebody who had shechted red deer in Europe. Otherwise, the position of Rabbi Belsky is that for mammals, if they have clearly split hooves, like all the other ones, they talked about it, not just you say it's split hoof, but split hoof exactly like the other ones, and they are ruminants just like the accepted kosher species. In other words, four stomachs, not like some of the animals have three stomachs, that we will accept them. And that was the position of Rabbi Bielski, why he would allow us, why he said he would allow us to shech the giraffe, and why he does allow us to shech the yak and the bison, because they're all clearly ma'alegeira, ma'frisi, parsa, exactly like all the animals which were ever being shechted. The birds were a little bit more difficult. To get the partridge, what we did was we set up a system. If you look in that letter which I wrote and Rabbi Bielski signed, now we have a system for deciding which birds we're going to permit. Birds is a real issue in the eyes of the OU because we hold that you really need a masseira to distinguish. Okay? Unlike mammals, where the Torah says, the Shulchan Aruch says, that you don't need a masseira. You may need a masseira to determine whether it's a chai or a behema, and that we follow the Chochmas Adam. We don't know an animal which we don't have a masseira on, whether it's a chai or a behema, like the bison, we treat like the sofik chai or sofik behema. We did kisui hadam without a bracha, but we don't eat the acharayim. We don't eat because we're choshish at the chaylev there. Okay? But birds, we absolutely need a masseira. So what will the OU accept as a masseira for birds? And this is the issue, one of the issues that we were talking about. And Rabbi Bielski decided that we need several conditions. First of all, and this is all based on the tshuva of Rav Moshe. If you read the tshuva of Rav Moshe, Rav Moshe said we can't eat pheasant, but he didn't say we can never eat pheasant. He said we can't eat pheasant based on what you're telling me because I went and asked Rabbi Karlebach and he doesn't know anything about eating pheasant. Right? And people, he says, and the name means nothing. Absolutely. You know, if you're going to tell, the question came up when the word got out that the OU permits quail. So somebody said, but there are 15 different species which are called quail, and they're not all the same. They're very different. So we decided like this. First of all, along the path that the OU will only give a hechsher to something which is shoveh l'chol nefesh, if there's a community that had a tradition not to eat this bird, then it will not get the OU. And that's what happened to the Muscovy duck. Because there were communities, rightly or wrongly, we're not posketing whether they have a right, whether their masseira was right or wrong. But since there were communities that deliberately avoided eating the Muscovy duck, we will not give a hechsher to Muscovy duck, no matter how many tshuvas a person writes trying to convince us that it was based on the fact that they didn't have an expert masseira. Okay? So that's number one, that we can't find a community that had a masseira to aser it. Number two, if the community didn't eat it, but it was simply because it wasn't commonly available there, that is not considered a masseira not to eat it. And in that case, we will accept a masseira to eat the bird. For instance, that's what we did with the second kind of partridge, the chukar partridge, which is not found in Europe and was never found in Europe. It's found in the desert. We got testimony from two sheikhtim who lived in Iraq and in another place, who shechted it. And in Europe, they didn't have it. Okay? Third thing is, the person who gives the testimony has to be a balki, which lemaisa means, remember we were talking about Rabbi Tzayed and Rabbi Chochem, he cannot be only a Rosh Yeshiva. He has to be somebody who works in the field, who knows the birds. And fourthly, he cannot do it on the basis of Rabbi Zivotofsky coming to him and asking him, is this quail kosher? He has to be shown the bird and say, yes, this is a bird that I shechted. Okay? And finally, among the requirements is Rabbi Bielski, in order to formalize this, wanted us to get a Maisei Bezdin. To get three people together to be makabel edus from this person, and we require that this person be a balki. We also require one other final thing. The scientific name of the bird. Because we cannot allow birds to be shechted just on the basis of a picture when there may be a completely different min which sort of looks like it and gets confused. So only if we have the scientific name will we allow that particular species of bird. And in the future, if we do, we're planning to do, we have the thought of doing future shchitas of partridge or things, we're going to have a farm which we go in and get edus on the specific birds we have and then close off the flock. They're only going to come from that flock. Okay. Now, finally, to talk... Yes? Locusts? No, locusts are clear. Ashkenaz had a masayah not to eat locusts. Whether it was because of Iyadiyah or not, the fact of the matter was Rashi says, we know the locusts. They're all around. He says, but we're not bucky, we don't eat them. Because of that, that's considered in our eyes a Kabbalah le'eso. I didn't say that. But the Chagogim, no, I'm connecting them because everybody agrees that the Chagovim, since there are species of grasshoppers which is kosher and species which are not kosher, everybody agrees that you have to have a tradition about what this kosher species is for a different reason than Neufis. Okay? Now, finally, 2 minutes on what the OU is doing to shore up the vados in the chain of meat. Somebody mentioned the Maisa Shehoya in Muncie. As you know, the OU was not directly involved there. That was not under a store which was under the OU. According to our policies, it would not have happened in a store that's under the OU because in a store that's under the OU, Rabbi Nathanson can correct me if I'm wrong, but the policy is that the mashgiach in the restaurant checks every single box of meat when it comes in to see that it's sealed properly and has the hechsher on it. And doesn't just say, oh, this bala bos is a haimishayid and a yirei shamayim, and therefore we can rely on him. You know, we take the position that that you can eat in somebody's house if you trust him. Eidachon nemen bisurim. But that doesn't mean, if I eat in Rabbi Grossman's house, that doesn't mean that I have any right to put up a sign outside his house that everything he cooks is under my hashkocha. It would be gnevas das for me to claim just because I'm trusting him. If you trust the other person that he's serving kosher, fine. Then it will go on under Rabbi Grossman's wife's name. And it will say, all the meat here is under... But how can another Rav come and say, I am responsible for the kashrus of the meat if he's not directly involved in the checking of the meat and he's relying on the fact that it's a haimishayid? I thought, the Tumasi, I thought that this issue in Muncie had really opened people's eyes and that people realized you can't eat meat unless the Rav HaMachshir takes responsibility for all the meat going into the store. He himself is involved in checking it. Well, I found out, unfortunately, to my chagrin, that's not the case, that there are lots of places in Brooklyn where they're still relying on the fact that the owner of the store is a haimishayid. Remember the difference. I'm not saying that you can't eat at the guy's house. The Torah says you can eat at the guy's house. But that doesn't mean you can put your name. Putting your name on it is telling people implicitly or explicitly that you are taking responsibility. It's simply not true if you're relying on the other person. What we are doing to try to fix this situation, to try to fix the various takolas, is we're trying to put in systems in place under the OU. Systems for packaging, which will be impossible to duplicate. This is something which has never been done before in the meat industry. There have been no attempts to try to push all the different meat companies to do one standardized thing. So you have to understand, you have to bear with us. It's going to take a little time. We cannot and we will not go to a company and say, change overnight, throw out all your packaging, bring in new packaging because we've decided. What we're doing is we're saying, this is what you have to commit to getting to within a certain number of months. And the packaging will have, it's a technical issues about how the packaging is done. I'm not going to bore you with them, but we're instituting packaging requirements which will obviate the issues of plumbers falling off chickens, will obviate the issues of straps coming off cartons. Rabbi Nathanson raises his eyes to the heavens. I can tell you, when I'm in the office in New York, which I'm not most of the time, but most of my calls are from a mashgiach, an OU mashgiach, who's doing what he should. He's checking the box to see whether it's sealed and has a heksher on it, but the straps fell off, or the box is torn. What is he supposed to do? In chinami, what is he supposed to do? So part of our rules is that the ikor packaging, the ikor siman, is going to be inside the box, and on outside the box, it's not going to be a siman. It's just going to be a hekel, so that when they unload it from the truck, the mashgiach can see, oh, yes, it has this heksher. But then when he opens it up, he has to see on everything inside that it has. There are lots of other things the OU is doing. I'm not going to bore you with them. I'm just going to tell you, b'kitzo, one klal that we're trying to do. The meat industry, as I tried to explain to people, has changed completely from 40 years ago. When I grew up, there was a local shechita in every community. There was a local shechita in Boston. There was a local shechita in Rabbi Teitz's community, I know very well. There were two Schlachtheis in Europe, near Elizabeth. Okay? The Shechita was done by people who lived in the community. The Rav in Boston, Rabbi Yosha Ber Soloveitch, Rabbi Teitz in Elizabeth, knew each Shechit personally. They davened in the shuls in his community, and he watched them to see whether they were cutting corners in davening. Okay? No, seriously, because the sheikhin and Boydek have to be Yorei Shamayim, because they can do something when they're pulling off the Sircha that I won't see. Or Drosa, you know that one of the Hamisha Psulei Shechita is you press with a knife. There is no way that somebody standing next to the sheikhin can assure you, Bavados, that there isn't Drosa. Because unless he's taking the knife and chopping off the head, he can be sawing back and forth and still doing Drosa. And you don't know. So the Shulchan Aruch says in these cases you need a Sheikhin and a Boydek who's Yirei Shamayim Barabim. The only place he says that. In the old days, the Sheikhtim lived in the community. The Rav of the community who gave the Heksher to the Shlachtois was responsible for the Yirei Shamayim. Furthermore, how many times did they go visit the Shlachtois? Every week, twice a week. Rabbi Yosef Singer, who's in our office, used to drive the Rav, who gave a heksher to Morrison and Schiff in Manhattan. Used to drive him once or twice a week down to Morrison and Schiff to look at it. Rabbi Teitz used to walk over from his house to it. Nowadays, where some of the Schlachtheiser that I go to are in the middle of nowhere, after you reach the middle of nowhere, you head 100 miles south. What? Who's going there every day? Okay? You go there. I go there. I do surprised, unannounced visits. But still, I don't have the control over what the sheikhtim are doing every day, like Rabbi Teitz did or the Rav did. Number three, I just gave an example to give you some idea. Steer are normally shechted when they're 1,200 pounds. Okay? Let's say half of that is the back part. So you've got 600 pounds in the front part. Let's say 50-60% of that is bone. How many pounds of meat are you left with for one steer? 400 pounds. 450 pounds, 400 pounds. Now, how many people do you need to eat 450 pounds of meat? If I had 450 pounds of meat, you couldn't all finish it this day. If this were carbon, it would become nicer. You cannot do it. In the old days, when you shechted cattle for Boston, when you shechted cattle for Elizabeth, how many did they shecht in the Schlachtois? 10? 12? Out of those, how many kosher did you get? You know, 4. And the Sheikhet could tell you at the end of the day the report on every single animal. He could tell you, this one had a siocha here, this one didn't have a siocha there. He knew every animal by personally. Now, in the slaughterhouses, they're doing several hundred a day. No Sheikhet, no Boydek can remember at the end of the day what he's done. So part of the issue that the OU is doing, and not only the OU, the other responsible Hashem for me, are trying to develop systems so that you don't need so much the involvement of the Sheikhet. You have already in the slaughterhouse a system to divide between, to assure which animals are glad, which animals are not kosher, which animals are stam kosher if they produce that, and which animals would be Beit Yosef. And the other thing you have to remember is that in slaughterhouses are the only are a sui generis kind of hashgacha that the OU gives. Normally, the way the OU maintains supervision on a plant is we make sure that all the ingredients going in are kosher, then everything inside is kosher. The only place where you're guaranteed to have non-kosher stuff, non-kosher deraisa, next to kosher stuff is in a meat house. You're guaranteed. There is no such thing as a slaughterhouse where it's all kosher. And so one of the issues that keeps me awake at night, and which I keep trying to think about, discussing with the Poiskim and the OU, is what can we do to try to keep ahead of the curve? Because just like the Schlachtheiser today are not like at all the Schlachtheiser 40 years ago, in 40 years they're also going to be very different. And the responsibility of a Hechsher like the OU is not to be reactive, but to try to think, stay in touch with the Schlachtheiser, what they're thinking to do, and try to think how we can implement controls that will ensure that the separation of the kosher and the non-kosher. Thank you. Yeah, get the numbers.